Today, from the Wings Archive, Wangari Maasai and the Greenbelt Movement of Kenya.
This is a grassroots environmental organization or movement which is mostly driven by women in the rural areas, but it is beginning to also get into the urban centers where it is mostly concerned about open green spaces, protection of such spaces to ensure that the public have access to them.
That's the voice of Wangari Maasai in 2002, 2 years before she received the Nobel Prize for Peace.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
While teaching veterinary anatomy at the University of Nairobi, the school's only Kenyan woman professor decided to run for parliament. But the country's one political party wouldn't accept her as a candidate, and then the college wouldn't renew her contract. So she volunteered with the Kenyan National Council for Women, encouraging educated women to share their knowledge. From her own shared knowledge in 1977, the famous Greenbelt Movement was born. Its women members have by now planted tens of millions of trees. Their founder won major environment and human rights honors. When opposition parties were allowed, she ran for president. She protested building a skyscraper in a forest and was beaten and jailed. In spring of 2002, she was a visiting professor of forestry at Yale University and gave this interview to Melinda Tuhus. The woman is Wangari Maasai.
When I first started in 1977, I was inspired by rural women who would attend meetings organized by the National Council of Women of Kenya. And these women would often say that their concerns were lack of firewood, lack of building and fencing materials, fodder for their animals, and also food for household consumption. And I was at that time teaching at the University of Nairobi, and I quickly felt that maybe that was just one of these inspirations that sometimes hit us, that I thought, well, why not plant trees? And I decided to encourage the women that we could establish tree planting by first asking foresters to give us trees, but eventually we had to educate and train women so that they would establish their own tree nurseries and they would become completely dependent in the production of trees. And this has been and continue to be the guiding light, that we respond to the needs of communities. We don't come with the preconceived ideas as to what communities need. We respond to what they say is their need, and of course, we are local, so it is very easy for us to identify these with the local communities and then empower them. And that's a very important word, empower them, so that they can do this for themselves rather than wait for the officials, the government, the aid agencies to come and do things for them.
I read in your biography that you were the first woman in Kenya to receive a PhD, is that right, in any field?
Yes, I have that privilege of having gone to school when many girls were not going to school. And so in 1971, I was one of the very few graduates in the University of Nairobi, and I received my PhD as a first woman in that region.
What was your own background that you were able to go to the university? How did you grow up and what did your parents do?
Well, my parents were ordinary peasant farmers in the countryside, but in a very beautiful part of the countryside. And I think that I was just lucky because they had the vision to let me go to school. I became very lucky because once I went to school, I did very well. And very quickly, I went into a boarding school and I did very well. And so it was a pleasure for me to go to school. I enjoyed school, and my parents were very happy to see that. They didn't have any problems with me. And by about the time I was in high school, many girls were by then going to school. And then in 1960, I was lucky again because I happened to be around and there was a scholarship available. And it's a long story, but to cut it short, I found myself in Atchison, Kansas, in a Benedictine college. And I spent 4 wonderful years there. And that actually is what changed my life.
Where did you do your graduate work?
I then moved to the University of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I did my master's. And after 2 years, I decided to go home. It had been 5 long years in the United States of America. So I went home and I joined the University of Nairobi from where I got my PhD.
What's the situation with women right now in Kenya in terms of education? Do many girls in the countryside still not get educated?
The legal expectation in Kenya is that every child should go to school. And in fact, even the ruling party promised in its manifesto as far back as 1963 that every child in Kenya should access at least primary education. But the reality is that that has not happened for many reasons we may not be able to get into here. And so it is still very dependent on parents whether they if they can send their children to school and whether they will choose to send both boys and girls to school or whether they will, because of the economic situation, only send boys.
You said you started the Greenbelt Movement in 1978 in response to rural women's concerns about needing firewood and needing fencing and all of that. And the Greenbelt Movement is responsible for planting millions of trees. Maybe you can update us on that.
Yes, it was started to meet the felt needs of the communities. And indeed, we have moved from just the tree planting campaign onto other issues, such as at the moment we have civic and environmental education, which is a very important component of the tree planting, where we try to educate communities so that they can be empowered and they can take the responsibility of managing their environment responsibly instead of allowing it to degrade just because the government is not there to do it for them. And this program also does look at our laws and our systems of governance in order for people to understand how they are governed, why they are governed like that, where their governments do not govern responsibly, and what they should do about it. And this has given rise to advocacy, where we sometimes have to express our strong opinion about how some of the natural resources are managed by the government, and in particular, forests. And some of you may have heard about our getting into trouble with the law, being arrested, being thrown into jail. It is usually because of this advocacy where we are trying to say that we have a right to a healthy environment. And therefore, if a person is destroying forests, and especially forests in watershed areas, then obviously such a person is interfering with your capacity to have a good quality environment. And so we say this is a violation of our environmental rights. The other program that we have, we call it business development program, where we try to generate income both internally and externally for the Greenbelt Movement. This is because the Greenbelt Movement has been very dependent on donors from outside. But we are also trying to see how we can generate income to make sure that the movement survives, especially beyond those of us who initiated it just about 25 years ago now. Now, in the course of those 25 years, wonderful things have happened and really give reason for us to have hope and to never give up, no matter how difficult sometimes these issues are and how frustrating sometimes it can be in working in our part of the world. The women have been able to plant over 20 million trees on their lands. And in some areas, the land has been completely transformed. And some of the women have had aspects of their life completely transformed. For example, they can give themselves firewood. They do not have to walk long distances to fetch for firewood. And for women who have done this in their lives, or women who had to save cash to buy firewood to cook with, or women who had to stop their children going to school, especially girls, so that they can go and collect firewood. For these women to be able to have firewood right there next to their household, it is quite a revolution in their lives. The other thing is, of course, the beauty of the countryside, the fact that other animals return, that there is an increase in biological diversity in the woods, and the fact that some of these trees can be used as fodder for the animals. Some of these trees are fruit trees, so they improve the diets, and of course they protect the soil. That was one of the major concerns for us at the beginning, is to stop soil erosion. Now I must say this is a war that we have not yet won, but I think the most important thing is that where we have been successful, that war has been won in that particular area. And more people today are becoming aware that soil erosion is a major crisis, and yet it is something that is preventable by doing very simple things on the land to ensure that soil stays on the land and does not get washed away by wind or by water into the streams or into distant places. So I would say without exaggeration that in Kenya we have a critical mass of people who now understand what the issue of environment is all about, and that today it is not possible even for the government to get away with mismanagement of the environment, especially of the forests. The people may not be able to do much about the government. They may not be able to stop the government destroying forests. They may not be able to stop the government privatizing, that is, giving itself chunks of the forest or exploiting the forest. But at least they are aware now that the government does not have a right to these resources, that the government is a custodian of these resources, that these resources belong to the people, both those who are here and those who are yet to come. And that to me is an extremely important understanding that our people needed to have, because for many years, governments have behaved as if they own the country, as if the natural resources are their own private resources that they can privatize themselves or give to their cronies and friends and political supporters. This kind of education has literally transformed the way our people think about the environment. And this to me is the biggest achievement, because to me it is not so important to plant a tree and to make it survive as important as that is. Much more important is to understand why you should do that, so that this can be sustainable, that you will also teach your children to do the same. This used to be the way we lived many, many centuries before colonial establishment, which detached people from the natural resources and the environment and their land. And now we are trying to tell people, you have left the land and all the common resources to a government that can easily mismanage them. So come back, reclaim your environmental rights, reclaim your right to live in a clean and healthy environment, and understand that you can make a difference, even if you're only a few, you can make a difference. The important thing is start. No matter how small the action is that you are doing, start. That's what is important, and sustain it. Maybe just an act of planting a tree. I mean, it's a very simple thing. You dig a hole, you get a tree, you stick in it, and you water it, and you nurture it. But it's amazing what that tree will do when it is about 30 feet high.
Now, Daniel Arap Moi has been president of Kenya almost the whole time your movement has been around. What do you see as the future, maybe 4 or 5 years down the road? Do you think there'll be a change in government?
I am sure that President Moi does not intend to run again, partly because the constitution does not allow him to run again, but also because politically and the psychology of the country is that they really expect him to leave. our concern now is how he will manipulate his transition, whether he will manipulate his transition and leave the country fragmented and fighting, people fighting among themselves, or whether he will be able to give us as peaceful a transition as his predecessor gave when he put him in power. I know that we should have elections this year, and therefore I'm hoping that we shall have a new person, but I'm afraid as long as the opposition is not able to unite and come up with a candidate, it is very likely that we shall continue to have KANU as the ruling party, and whether Moi is there or not, it is likely that he'll put his crony, somebody who can protect him from all the economic and social and human rights crimes that he has committed. The responsibility of creating a more stable and a more prosperous Kenya depends on the people. If the people are not willing to sort out their differences, not willing to see through the smokescreen that President Moi creates for them, then they have nobody but themselves to blame.
I wanted to ask you two kind of related questions about public health and women. Kenya for a while had the highest birth rate in the world. I know it's come down quite significantly since then. Can you just talk about the relationship between very high birth rate and environmental issues like lack of firewood?
Yeah, well, I think that the population factor has been played a lot, and especially late 60s and early 70s, Kenya was said to be having a population rate of about 4%, and this was projected everywhere as an alarming rate. But I should say that personally I have never been worried about the population issue, because I think quite often we over-concentrate on the population issue and forget other issues that are probably much more important, because Kenya has 30 million people, and that is not many by any standard. Africa in general has just a little over 500 million people, and that's a big continent. So I think that the population issue in Africa is often overplayed, and the issues such as corruption, the issues such as bad governance by leaders, who especially during the Cold War were supported by the superpowers and their allies, and therefore the mismanagement that these leaders brought to the country and made it very difficult for people to develop and to improve their quality of life, are quite often not brought to the table, and instead we concentrate on the population issue. At the moment, I understand that the population is increasing by about 2.5%. So as you say, it has come down very drastically, and so we shouldn't be worried at all. But even more devastating, I should say, at the moment, is the death rate that is now due to AIDS. Due to mostly the mismanagement of our countries, the mismanagement of our economies, our people have become very poor. According to the World Bank, 56% of Kenyans live under $1 a day. That's more than 15 million people who are poor. Those people aggregate, especially in cities. They migrate into cities thinking that there is better life in cities. They end up in huge slums. Kenya is now having some of the largest slums. A large number of those who migrate are men, both old and young, who go looking for jobs, and they leave their families behind. And any adult person knows what happens when this kind of migration takes place. And so when aid hit Kenya in 1984, unfortunately our leaders hid their heads in the sand, and they did not alarm the people. They did not do what President Museveni of Uganda was doing in Uganda, telling their people openly that aid is going to kill them, that it was there, that it is only passed through, mainly through sexual contact, and therefore people must be careful. And therefore, because we pretended that there was no AIDS, because, as you probably know, we were trying to protect tourism, which was a very lucrative business, still is to a large extent, the spread of AIDS has been astronomical. And therefore, we are losing a lot of people. We understand that we are losing no less than 700 persons per day. And these are mostly the reproductive age of between 15 and 45. And so we are inheriting thousands of orphans who are now having to be raised by their grandparents. These obstacles, many of them are global in nature. They are caused by decisions that are being made in London, they're being made in Tokyo, they're being made in Paris, they're being made in Washington, D.C. And these are the problems that make development very difficult. If we were able to develop, if we had good governance, if we were able to manage our resources properly, if we did not have the interference of the global community that is so keen on exploiting our resources and giving us virtually nothing in return, the population issue would not be there. We would be wanting to increase our population rather than fighting to decrease our population.
AIDS was the other question I was going to ask you about, and I'm glad you raised it. Are there grassroots efforts, maybe run by women in Kenya, to deal with the issue of AIDS and to talk about prevention? Are there programs that are working there now?
There are very many groups and agencies all trying to do something about AIDS. Even the Kenya government at the moment is in the forefront trying to fight AIDS now that it has blown up and has caused havoc. And it is a real tragedy. And people are just falling over like flies. And I don't think there is one single family that is not affected. And so it's a real tragedy. Now, there are very many people, including, I wanted to say, the government is now in the forefront. It is getting a lot of support from international communities, including people like Gates, contributed a lot to this effort. And there are very many governments that have come to our aid to try to help us. But I think that even then, it's a very difficult disease because it's a disease that deals with some of the most private relationships we have. And you don't know that you have it until you have it. And once you have it, it's almost like your fate is sealed. So it's a very, very tragic thing. Now, in the Greenbelt movement, we have not been dealing with the disease from a health point of view, partly because we have not been able to get the resources to do so. But we do give education. When we do our what we call civic and environmental education seminars, where we discuss about all aspects of governance, health, and some of the issues that are facing the community today, we do give information. So we get people who are infected with AIDS, we get people who have information about AIDS, we get doctors, and they come and they talk to us, and we are hoping that this information is going back into the rural areas and it's going to help.
The part of the country where you grew up, and you said it was a lovely part, and you came from a farming family. Just describe what that was like when you were growing up.
The other day I visited school here at New Haven, and I was talking to the first graders. They wanted to know about what I do. And what I told those children in a nutshell is that when I was growing up, when I was about their age, I would go to the river. It's really a stream, a very small stream, which was next to our household. And I would go and fetch water right from the river and bring to my mother. And we would drink that water straight from the river. It was so clean, nothing could happen to us. And it was literally gushing out of the ground. I could literally see the water coming from the ground. And then I would restrain it and take it to my mother. And during a certain time, especially just before the rains, the frogs would lay their eggs in this stream. Now that tells you how beautiful, how clean, and how softly flowing the waters were, because otherwise you wouldn't have frog eggs. I would play for hours with the frog eggs. And as I told the kids, I thought the frog eggs were beads. And I thought that if I would go under them, very, very gently, I could pick them up and put them around my neck, and how beautiful I would look with all these millions of eggs around me. I didn't know they were eggs. I actually thought they were beads. But every time I would try to pick them up, the jelly would break. And I would try again, and the jelly would break. And so I had this frustration, but also fascination of playing around with these eggs until my mother would call me because she was waiting for the water. Now, I told the kids that this was around late 50s. And then I came to America for almost 5 years. And by the time I got back, guess what? They had introduced cash crops. There were coffee, there were tea, where there had been woods and bushes and woodlots. All these had been cut down to make way for tea and coffee. And I also told the children that very close to my household, there was a huge, I mean huge fig tree. And this fig tree, my mother had told me I should not collect any firewood from it because it belonged to God. This is because our people prayed under the tree. They didn't pray the tree. They prayed under the tree. They knew there was a creator who created them and who also created this fig tree. But to cut a long story short, the people, in order to make way for coffee and tea, and because as they became Christians, they lost the respect that our traditional people had for the land and for the trees and the whole concept that this tree is a tree of God. They literally cut it so that it would make way for coffee bushes and tea bushes. Well, what happened? As the tree disappeared, so did my stream, and so did the frogs and the eggs and the tadpoles that usually would come out of those eggs. I should have said that after some time, all the eggs would disappear, and I would see millions of tadpoles in that little stream. And I would try to catch them, but ever try to catch a tadpole by the tail? Impossible. But I would try with my little fingers, I would try to catch them, and it was just fascinating. Now that is the country I grew in. The beauty, the cleanliness, the contact with nature. Now, today, my children cannot do that because the stream is gone, the tree is gone, and so are the frogs. And that is what we are trying to resuscitate. That wonderful, wonderful world which we had inherited from our parents and which we are not able to pass on to our children.
2 years after this interview by Melinda Tuhus, Wangari Maathai became the first African woman to win a Nobel Peace Prize. On September 25, 2011, Wangari died of cancer at age 71. Her impact on Kenya and on the world lives on. To hear this program again, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.